suddenly there is a new people's hero, Mick Lynch of the RMT. If you haven't seen him on video dismantling every hostile, suspicious establishment media commentator, then you really haven't been watching. What lies behind his success? And is the union movement now starting to throw up some very different kind of activist politicians who rather throw a difficult light on the establishment politicians who can't duck and weave nearly as well? We discuss. We look also at the claims about the rail dispute of being about modernisation, according to the British government and the train companies. Is that just weasel words, really? We try to dig a little beneath that. We look also at the Patrick Grady business and the apology that didn't really amount to apology by Ian Blackford, and why the SNP seems more concerned on how a leak appeared than the contents of that leak, which is disappointing. And we look as well at what's likely to be said by Nicola Sturgeon next week when she explains how Scotland can get an official legal referendum next year. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Choms, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And in honour of Leslie's appearance on Debate Night last week, and in homage to my granny's favourite Saturday night light entertainment programme, The Billy Cotton Band Show, Wakey Wakey!
I like this really is one for the teenagers, because like half the audience will not know what you're talking about, Mr. Joyce.
Yes. It was what passed for entertainment in the 50s and 60s, and it was in black and white. And we lived in black and white at that point. But yes, Debate Night, interesting one, because there was Ella Robertson, a Conservative activist, Craig Hoy, the Conservative MSP, Maggie Chapman of the Greens, Neil Gray, SNP, and your good self. So rather an odd one, because I can't actually think back to a time when there was a majority of indie supporters on a programme like Debate Night.
Yeah, it was a bit different, although the totally surprising thing about it, and I know she'll be listening, is that Ella actually listens to this podcast.
Oh, right.
Yes. Okay. And you'd have had to have watched the programme to really get the jaw-dropping nature of that. If she's listening, Ella, you did actually manage to surprise me more than practically anything for the last 5 years with that one, because it would be fair to say Ella is a pretty true blue lass. And I can't quite see what, you know, unless it's just scoping the arguments of the opposition or whatever. Mm-hmm. But she seemed to be extremely sincere when she came up, actually, and said that she really loved the podcast. So anyway, that was a sort of, it's just as well I didn't hear that beforehand, actually, because that really would have thrown me. As it was, my job on it, I thought, was to just try to cut through a lot of the kind of ping pong that just started immediately. You know, you haven't got the right to have an indie ref. Yes, we have. No, you haven't. Yes, we have. No, you haven't. You haven't got a proper majority. Yes, we have. No, you haven't. Yes, we have. You should have only had one ever indie ref. You know, that's what Alex Salmond promised. No, he didn't. Yes, he did. No, he didn't. And I sort of, you know, listening to this, I was just kind of thinking, actually, we've lost, you know, yes has lost the second that we go down these rabbit holes. Whether you succeed in arguing the case or not, it's actually, this is mocking my opinion, but it's so boring and it's so procedural. And it's exactly what, you know, a clever set of no representatives will do, is to try to get you just basically, you know, doing the automatic gainsaying that Monty Python's argument sketch so hated.
Yeah.
Because it's boring. What you want in an argument is a well-constructed, you know, somewhere to go, you know. So there was a stage where I can't remember which was the one that came my way first, but I just decided to have a wee go at Craig Hoy, who was sitting beside me, who had actually been sitting in a slightly Tourette's manner, jibing away, you know, every time Neil was from Orkney, for the SNP, Neil Gray speaker was, you know, listing something, he would say, what about ferries? What about this? What about that? You know, I mean, just like a constant blizzard of interruption. So I had turned to him at one point and I was trying to take the thing somewhere and was trying to make a point. Actually, the question was about the rail strike, but I thought, let's just go off on where are workers generally in this country and just make some points about, you know, the low pay, the precarious nature of life. And then I thought, let's just try him on this. And I turned to him and said, you know, we've got the lowest welfare benefits in Europe, Craig, haven't we? And he basically said, what? He just hadn't been listening. So I did actually say to him, I'm sorry, have I woken you up? Whatever. And I mean, it was just a little bit of crack, basically. But it did seem to sort of go quite viral, you know, as a wee bit of video, which the debate night hoiked out. And then there was another one that was, you know, on a similar sort of thing of just trying to basically go for it and try to advance reasons for why you would want independence. Because otherwise, you know, you end up that they get you that you can't speak about the future. You can't speak about what you're the whole reason that you're there. You end up just firefighting on lots of little minute points. So it was quite jolly. And of course, it followed the release of Nicola Sturgeon's first paper, which suddenly kind of, you know, jacked up quite a few different kind of, you know, I think they changed the nature of the debate night's panel because the focus was going to be on, well, what the heck's happening, which you would have to say, what the heck is happening, actually. So, yeah, that was quite fun.
Yeah, because what I found interesting watching it was that whole focus on process rather than substance. And yet, when Nicola Sturgeon and Patrick Harvey launched the new paper and launched the NDRF campaign too, they specifically said, what we don't want to do is get caught up in process. We want to talk about substance. And lo and behold, it went on about process. And I thought you were actually very restrained and very tolerant. It took a heck of a long time for Stephen Jordan to actually get to you.
Yes, but I think what happens is that it used to be the case that when you're in a situation like this, you've got almost a tick box, somebody sitting with a stopwatch on the different political parties so that they actually get even times. And since there was kind of a disproportion, you know, there was three of us and two of them, essentially, you know, they had to get their money's worth before they brought in the kind of non-party political person. Yeah. Because there's a lot of complaints from the parties when their guys don't get, you know, front of house. So it did take a while to come around. But then again, you know, what are you going to do? Just jump into the middle of things? I mean, you know, it's quite tightly controlled at the front. And I did begin to think, this is getting a bit, you know, a bit weird. But, you know, in the end, it's what's memorable out of something, I think. So, you know, as long as you've got space to say something memorable. And the point is, you take it.
Yeah.
You know, because the second you're given space, take it. You know, there's no point, even if you're answering the question as it's been answered. Now, it really annoys people when folk don't answer a very specific question. But you have to try and go somewhere. The reason that people get annoyed by a lot of obfuscation from politicians is that they're generally not saying anything very interesting instead, you know. So I think if you take the ball and run somewhere kind of quite interesting with it, you'll mostly take the audience with you.
Yeah, well, sticking with independence referendum, fingers crossed that it's all going to happen, according to Angus Robertson, in October 2023. Interesting proposal from Alex Rowley that there should be a third option on any ballot. And congratulations. I mean, I've got a lot of time for Alex Rowley and Neil Findlay, who spoke of. They're both Labour politicians who are actually firmly committed to the aspect of the fact that there is a mandate for another independence referendum. And Alex has proposed that third way, which is, hello again, it's home rule, whatever that actually means. That he's going wants that to be on the ballot.
Yeah, I wrote a thing for the Herald on Monday that was looking at that, which, I mean, basically, when you begin to think about it, it is quite priceless, because the level of double standard now is just extraordinary. I mean, one minute the SNP don't have a mandate for NDREF 2 because apparently the 2019 election wasn't really about independence and Nicola went quiet about independence. The next minute, as in that debate night, the SNP are accused of talking about nothing but independence to whip up division. Well, you can't have it both ways. You know, which is it? Then you get Anas Sarwar condemning the Scottish Government for contemplating a referendum without Section 30 powers. So basically overreaching its current limits completely. And the next, you get Alex Rowley suggesting that NDREF 2 should have a Devo Max option, even though delivery of that is also beyond the limits of Holyrood, yeah, and indeed them. You know, so it's kind of, it really is extraordinary how often we have to go through this one. But, you know, the Labour Party has not got the ability, or it would look at the moment like any inclination to do the nearest thing to federalism. Gordon Brown, you know, 2 years with his commission that he was appointed to do 2 years ago. I mean, we still haven't heard anything out of that. Because it's sitting trying to get some enthusiasm going, presumably for federalism in England, you know, that old one. And then the thing that was really quite interesting in it was that I was asked on the BBC Radio Wales programme Sunday Supplement. Mm. And this was really very interesting because what the Vaughan Roderick, who runs it, presents the programme, actually sort of corrected me on the programme by saying, well, actually, Labour in Wales very often hold events to discuss independence. I thought, really? Mm-hmm. And then, in fact, you know, there's even more than that. Someone tweeted after that to really back that whole point up, Rachel Garriach, who is co-chair of Labour for Indy Wales and a county councillor, and she said, I don't think I could be more openly pro-Indy. It's a different political environment in Wales. Labour has appointed a minister for the constitution. And remember, Labour is the government in Wales, whose brief is to look at how Wales go forward. Labour prefers a federal model for the UK, but a year out from IndyRef too, and this shows you how the ripples are extending, we need to consider the future may be very different. And actually, she sent me a thing today as well, which shows the consultation document that the Welsh government has, the Labour Welsh government has just released. And in the options that it asks the public to comment on, option 6 includes, should we go for independence? That's from the Labour Party in Wales. So it just kind of, you know, gives you a bit of a glimmer about how sterile the opposition from Scottish Labour really is. They've got, the last time there was an opinion poll done, at least a third of their members support IndyRef too. And yet, it can't be mentioned, you know, which is just really quite extraordinary.
I mean, I'm just trying to actually figure out why Welsh Labour, I mean, and I'm going to use this phrase advisedly, are getting away with it, considering Keir Starmer and recently David Lammy's statement that we are a unionist party. How are they managing to find that gap to be able to operate in that way, to actually have the grown-up sensible discussion about the fact that if, you know, there is a way forward, that they're going to have to examine all the options, including independence?
Well, I don't know, but it might be that that, you know, Plaid Cymru are kind of biting at their heels, and that the distinctions that they have to make are between themselves and Plaid, basically. That's where they see the kind of danger from their mm-hmm. voting. So they have to make it look like they're at least considering this. But there you go. You know, it's an extraordinary one. And the thing that's very clear, really, from the kind of, you know, lackluster noises that come from Keir Starmer et al, is basically the Devo Max cavalry ain't coming.
No.
You know, as we've said many times before, and then the thing that is it's perfectly acceptable to promise what cannot be delivered on
exactly.
one side of our national debate, but then it's a crime against humanity practically to explore the limits of Holyrood's powers in what Nicola Sturgeon looks like she's proposing to do. And there was an interesting piece in The National today, actually, trying to sketch out what that might be, with an Aberdeen University law lecturer called Scott Crichton-Stiles. And he was suggesting that what might kind of get through is a question that's different to the previous one, which could be, should the British Parliament grant legal permission to the Scottish Parliament to hold a referendum on Scottish independence, mm-hmm. yes or no? Now, that would be quite an interesting one, because obviously there's a bigger constituency for the democratic right to have a referendum mm-hmm. than there possibly is for independence. So if that's where Nicola's going, and we'll know by Tuesday next
yes.
week, that could be quite a cunning one, because whilst the Tories will doubtless, and, you know, Labour, well, the leadership will try to say that there's no way they're even going to get involved with that if it finds its way through court. And you'd have to say also, if Scotland's leading law officer, the Lord Advocate, decides that it's something that is at least within the powers enough for her to let the ball start to roll through Holyrood. But I mean, if that's what's envisaged, okay, a lot of people will go, well, hey, that's not a proper indie ref. That's just a kind of, you know, please miss, can we sort of referendum. And yet it could actually be quite a powerful thing to have happen if, as is expected, you know, Boris Johnson ain't going to turn. There's definitely some manoeuvring going on, room for manoeuvre. And whilst it's frustrating that the troops don't have a clear idea of what we're supposed to be doing at the moment, if that's the direction we're going in, then it would begin to look like something that is doable and also gets to the, I was going to say sweet spot, but difficult spot for parties like Labour, who will now look extremely anti-democratic when their Welsh colleagues are not only able to take on board the idea of a referendum, but also even the option of openly discussing independence.
Yeah, because Kerry Farquharson in the Times wrote an article which saying that Nicola Sturgeon was kind of running scared because she was going for the referendum in 2023 because she feared a general election and Labour gaining power. I mean, and I find it incredible to actually think about that, because Labour actually has their 150 seats. The Fabian Society did this. The 150 seats where Labour came closest to the winning party, 125 of these are England and Wales. I mean, a lot of them are in the red wall. The next thing that has to happen here is that Labour, in order to actually diminish Conservative, the number of Conservative MPs, has to reach some form of agreement, tacit or otherwise, in the blue wall seats with the Liberal Democrats. And then, let's just hang on about this, 25 potential targets are in Scotland. And in these 25 seats, the Fabian Society have identified that the vote for the SNP went up in the last general election. So there you've got it. I mean, you've got that issue of you can promise as much as you like, but if it all depends upon Labour under the slightly less than overwhelming Keir Starmer in his current leadership, where he's got his own party extremely dissatisfied with the promises that he made in terms of support for the trade union movement, a commitment to democratic socialism. He seems to be running away from that. I doubt the potential for a Labour government actually exists. And then you add on to the point, if there'll be any appetite at that point for Labour to introduce a federal UK. And we come back to that continuing point, and it's really boring. Power devolved is power retained. Because if it's a devolution settlement, as we can identify what's going to happen with the European Convention on Human Rights, which is enshrined in the Scotland Act, the UK government decides they're going to go ahead and we're going to introduce the British Human Rights Act, bang, it can be taken away.
Well, I see, because that was another moment from the debate night thing when I was asked, you know, what differences, what's changed since 2014? And of course, there's many things go through your mind. But I was just reading the audience and just said, Boris Johnson. And there's just automatic applause. And actually from unionists in the audience, because by that stage, you could kind of see where everybody was sitting. Because pretty much he does just embody lying. I mean, and that's I think said that Boris Johnson, Brexit and lying, basically. And you know, you're looking at people and nobody's shaking their heads at that point. You know, there's no disagreement with that, which is again in argument terms where I think everybody has to keep getting back to, which is get to the proposition people will agree with and then try to take them somewhere difficult.
Yeah.
You know, what often people get backed into is having to make the case for something that is a bit difficult. The selling proposition, as my brother, who was involved in sales in his younger life, used to keep telling me, is to get to a situation where every proposition you're putting to someone produces the answer yes. I mean, this was actually came from a time when he took me to buy a car. My God, you know, decades ago, and the guy was basically trying to sell the car to him, you know, because he was a man, not me. And Graham was kind of really annoyed that this basic error had happened, that the guy hadn't even established who was actually buying the car. But he did give him marks for the rest of it. You know, it was like, yeah, five doors in a car, very useful for all those big, heavy loads. Yes. The color, whatever it was, doesn't show the dirt. Yes. Whatever else about the car, useful, you know, movable wing mirrors or something, very useful again. Yes. Would you like to have a test drive? Yeah, it's difficult to say no because you're encouraging a yes thing in the mind. So I think when people are trying to make the argument for anything in a public event like this, you have to get straight to the points, read the audience, and you have to get to the points where people will not disagree, because at that point they don't barrack you, and you get a small period of time where you can push out your own ideas and then take people to something that might be the point they at the beginning would have been a little questioning about, you know. But anyway, yes, I mean, certainly, as soon as you sort of mentioned Boris Johnson, which is, of course, what is not going to be mentioned. He's not going to be mentioned by the other guys. So you have to kind of bring that game to them.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back at the Conservative Party, we had Murdo Fraser inadvertently making the case for independence, which I thought was absolutely astonishing. I don't know if people saw this when he was asked, I think it was GB News, he was asked, you know, why shouldn't England, you know, just get rid of Scotland? They went through a whole list of things which said the massive contribution economically that Scotland made to the United Kingdom. And I'm going, does he actually realise what he's just done? I mean, it was outstanding. And then on top of it, we had Alistair Jack saying to Deirdre Bock, when she was talking about the Levelling Up Fund and the UK government again going out with the devolved settlement and going straight to local councils, telling Deirdre Bock to suck it up. I mean, I'm thinking, this is just... I mean, to hear a minister of the Crown actually talking that way in a committee to a fellow MP, it takes a lot to shut me up and go, you're what? But I couldn't actually believe it was hearing.
Yeah, yep, absolutely, yeah. The stuff comes thick and fast at the moment, but still the question is... I think the question still is, we've got to frame our thinking bigger than even all of this gotchas and whatabouts and so on, because we're going now for the big sort of argument. And we also have to, so much of people's judgment is about the way people approach something. And I don't know if whether we're able to jump to this yet, but because we're in a funny day today, well, it's a funny day, it's Wednesday, because I was coming back from the Western Isles because I was sort of relaunching the Hebrides book there, and basically just got back home at kind of about 10 o'clock last night. So we're doing what we promised we would never do again, which is we're doing this in a brain dead state at 7 o'clock at night after you've had the bairns all day and I've spent the day writing a column and falling asleep. But Mick Lynch, you've got to say, what a guy, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, I actually spent the morning catching up on all of this. And we did speak about this before, because I had suggested in a column some weeks ago that the British government was actually motoring towards trying to turn the inevitable rail dispute that was brewing at a British level into a rerun of the miners' strike to try and kind of pump up the volume and get the old divisions going. Epic distraction, you know, all the rest of it. But by gum, they didn't reckon with Mick Lynch. I mean, if everybody's been watching, I'm sure that everybody will have been watching all the clips that have been circulating with him, which are just priceless. There was one on, I mean, and this is the great thing about him. He's on so many times, you go, if you quite like him, it's like an author. You know, if you like the first book, it's great. There's another five on the shelf. Well, just go in and have a look, because if you like the way he dealt with Kirsty Wark's Newsnight moment, where he had a British government minister on, you know, another chinless wonder you'll never even have heard of. And the guy was, Chris Philp, was basically claiming that the RMT had walked away from talks. Now, the thing is, you do, you know, normally people will sit there and they'll listen while the other person talks absolute shite, basically. And then you get your chance. But the second that he claimed that made that claim, you know, Mick Lynch was basically saying, that's a lie, a direct lie. He's lying. That's a lie. That's a lie. Right the way what he was through what he was speaking. And it was an interesting way that he did it, because that's a bold thing to do, to just jump straight in and essentially break all the rules. Because normally, you know, you get to a point where if you try to talk over people, it actually annoys the audience. You know, it's not just a question of not being cricket. It's that you can feel that the audience is going, would you let the guy speak? But he was so obviously incensed. You know, it was like a line had immediately been crossed where he's listening to this guy lie and he's just not going to wear it. And when Chris Philp had actually ground to a halt, he said, you also lied that we left negotiations on Saturday and went to a rally. There were no negotiations scheduled for Saturday. You are a liar. And the thing is, that is an excellent little bit of interruption, because it was short to the point. And you remember what he said. And basically, Chris Philp had gone blimmin' white by this point, you know. I mean, I don't know which one's your favourite. There's also an excellent Kay Burley one. Did you see that?
Yes, I saw the Kay Burley one where he's turning around when Kay Burley was talking. She was at what Richard Madeley did as well. I mean, the greatest Alan Partridge impression I've seen in my life. But what Kay Burley was turning around saying, what are your tactics for picketing? What are you going to do if people actually cross the picket line? Try to cross the picket line and says, well, what we do if they're going to go to work? We'll actually explain to them what's going on. But what are your tactics? What will you do? And he's going, look behind you. There are about half a dozen people standing there very peacefully with placards and banners, totally obeying the law. And he kept saying, well, what are you going on about? What are you going on about? And she directly referred to them, I'm old enough to remember the miners' strike. And that was that one there. But that was a cracker. And Joe Coburn talking about the fact that was it a personality clash, a battle of personalities between Mick Lynch and Boris Johnson, to which the reply was, well, wait a minute, you've been asking in all these programmes and you seem to be startled to discover a working class man who left school at 16 actually has a personality and has a debating style that they'll rip the arse out of all these Tories. You seem to be shocked at this fact. I mean, because he's a remarkable man, Lynch. I mean, he worked in construction, joined the trade union, was illegally blacklisted as a result, then switched to working on the railways. And he got
and
his
then
money.
And then won the settlement for being illegally blacklisted from his earlier job after 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, he's some stubborn kind of operator there. But it's that thing again of he's comfortable in his own skin. He's got all the arguments rehearsed. He knows what he's going to say. He knows what they're going to pick up on. And this is another thing, because when you're sitting waiting to go on to one of these things, you can sit rehearsing your own little lines. But really, the thing you have to do is think what difficult questions will you be asked? And personally speaking, that's all I focus on. I just think it's obvious how that you're going to be winged. You can tell, you know, beforehand the kind of difficult questions you're going to get. Just rehearse. How are you going to answer them and where are you going to take it really quickly? I mean, the good thing about Mick Lynch is he's very, very succinct and quick in his answers. Yep. So it's not like, you know, he's not just sort of disturbing the apple cart to give you, you know, just chaos. He actually reorients the argument into something which is very true. I mean, he does it very quickly into an attack on the incredible wealth that's been earned during, you know, COVID, for example. In fact, just generally by mega corporations. But the thing I was noticing about this, and I've written about this for tomorrow's National, tomorrow being Thursday at this moment in time, is, well, first of all, the RMT was actually made history in 2014 as the first major trade union to back Scottish independence. And that was after a ballot of their Scottish members produced a yes majority, a narrow majority, but nonetheless. And the RMT Scottish organiser at the time, Mick Hogg, said, I believe an independent Scotland will be a beacon of hope and aspiration to the working class communities of the UK, Europe and beyond. A yes vote will see the needs of the millions put before the greed of the millionaires. So great. You know, I mean, people may not remember this, but that's the union Mick Lynch is leading. Now, I haven't been able to see anything about him talking personally about independence, but the point of it seemed to be more that the union simply opted for internal democracy. They let their own Scottish members choose instead of imposing a London view, which many other unions did. And that's all that fair-minded Scots should be asking for, is just, you know, the right to sort that out yourself. The other thing that strikes me is that essentially Lynch is coming from somewhere that is not, he is not alone, because there's been quite a change in the way that the union movement organises behind the scenes. And although the prevailing narrative is that trade union membership has been, you know, smashed since the summer of discontent in 1978, and it's true, it's much lower, but actually there's been a slow and steady growth in membership that started in 2018 and peaked probably during the pandemic. Just one union, Unison, had more than 10,000 workers join in the first half of 2020, and that was 150% up on the previous year. The TUC's Join a Union website page was also up sixfold, and female union membership has seen the biggest rise. So something's happening, and then those kind of unions joining, and according to Peter, he says the folk who are joining trade unions are not returning miners, they're not steel workers, they're generally workers who've never been in a union before. So that the kind of the number of people in the care sector was up 200% in 2020. So workers, you know, as he put it, workers were looking for PPE in terms of physical protection, and then protection as workers by joining unions. And now there's a different concern, obviously, because people want to be protected against miserly 1% pay rises in the face of, you know, 9% inflation. But what's happening is that there's new bespoke small unions moving in to almost replace some of the complacent, bureaucratic, weak unions, basically. Nifty unions, the cleaners union that won the London Living Wage for cleaners at a Nike store. The Independent Workers Union that got a 25% pay rise for bike couriers, the Bakers Union that won a pay rise for McDonald's workers. And then if you actually look further afield, in the United States, unions have really made a comeback and have actually challenged both Starbucks and Amazon, who all had no union agreements. So you couldn't have union representation in either company. And they've managed to get union recognition in both companies by democratic votes, simply by managing to outmaneuver consultants brought in by the companies to essentially act as agents provocateurs, moving amongst the workforce and constantly dissing the cause of being in a union and the consequences of being in a union. And they've done this really quite cleverly. They've been organizing online. There's an expert, John Logan, Professor John Logan, who says he thinks younger workers are using social media to outmaneuver consultants, to create worker-to-worker contacts instead of arranging cumbersome general meetings that people notice. Mm-hmm. And they're also very able and willing to disrupt company events, like walk straight in and do basically a Mick Lynch. You know, where you can see how the whole thing's tilted. You can see it's all properly arranged and there's, you know, the mics in the front of the room and all the rest of it. And these young union members are walking straight in and just saying, you're lying. They're absolutely disrupting the terms of trade. So, again, the union here that looks like it's trying to emulate some of that is Unite, which is a massive union. Sharon Graham became its first ever female general secretary last year. She beat two male allies of the outgoing boss, Len McCluskey. And by all accounts, the reason that she astonished everyone by winning was because she was very active in the online strike school that's been going on in the background, educating new members into how to go on strike, how to stay safe on strike, how to speak to one another, how to address management. And all of that's been going on completely beneath the radar. You know, nobody, I don't think this has really hit the headlines at all. And it was those members who saw an activist in Sharon Graham, a feisty woman who wasn't going to sit and kind of, you know, burnish the kind of brass on the front desk of the office, but was actually going to get going. And lots of female union leaders like Sharon Graham from a totally different type of background have worked their way right through. And once again, Sharon Graham's union, I mean, she personally is actually also pro-Indie Ref and pro the right to choose from the Scots. So there's things happening there, and they could actually be a wee lesson for the S campaign because Essentially, articulate, no-nonsense leaders like Mick Lynch and Sharon Graham are in because they're activists and they cut to the chase. And tired, hesitant, should we say, pen-pushing bureaucrats are out. So we need to make sure that's the way that we're approaching this, with the sort of, if you like, Mick Lynch approach. We're not sitting politely waiting to basically get difficult questions thrown our way and then catching them. We're actually hurrying from the second you're on stage. You're awake, you're moving forward, and you're passionate.
Yeah. And compare and contrast with Keir Starmer and the Labour front bench reaction to the RMT strikes, where there was a thou shalt not go on picket line, thou shalt not do this. And Emily Thornberry, I don't know if you saw this, referred to Labour MPs, and she would include in this, even though she didn't mention his name, Anna Sarwar, she referred to those who actually went on the picket line to support the RMT as bag carriers. Demeaning them, diminishing them, seeing these were junior people. And what Starmer also did at question time was he picked up on comments that had been made by a variety of Conservative MPs, turning around and saying, and do you realise, in addition to people not being able to get to hospital, kids not being able to get exams, do you realise that the veterans not going to be able to attend Armed Forces Day because of this strike? And Starmer, in his desire to triangulate and become the patriotic flag-waving party, turned around and said, and do you realise, because this government's not getting involved, we've got veterans who can't attend, you know, Armed Forces Day. And they are unsure about who they are, what they want to say. And yet again, a Labour Party, which is not coming out clearly and stating that they support the workers' right to strike, not just the right to strike, but this strike. Individual MPs, individual activists will do it, but the Labour Party itself, as has done in the past and continues to do, is not supporting the strike. And it's extremely disappointing. And I thought Mick Lynch is another one. He was talking to Barbara Chapman, who is a Labour peer, and he turned around and said, and who are you anyway? I don't know who you are. And I thought it was just superb to actually turn and say, well, who are you anyway? You know, yeah. I know who I am. I know who I represent. My members, I know clearly what they want. They voted in overwhelming numbers for the strike. I know my stuff. I know where I stand. I know my beliefs, and I know what I'm doing. And it was a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, it totally was. And it did remind me of, I did an interview, now I'm trying to remember who with, actually in the I Write Book Festival many years ago, Paul Mason, who had written a book about capitalism at that point. And, he was sort of saying every time there's this reference back to the 70s is this scary time when everything's sort of out of control. He was saying, it's completely the opposite. It was a time when there was still vigorous defence of the interests of working people. And what we've got, there was a lot of flexing of muscles, because in an us versus them society like Britain, that's as good as you get. You know, if you live somewhere else, you might well have a situation where, hesitate to bring the Nordics back into it. But, any of these countries will have joint committees running businesses which have got union, lots of union representation on it. And you can't actually turn up and hope to speak to anyone when one of these events is on, because they are absolutely unmovable. They're so important. It's funny because watching Mick Lynch reminded me of the Icelandic trade union leader that we had at a previous Nordic Horizons event, who finally couldn't come, and I had to interview her on Zoom. Because she was actually in the middle of a nurses strike. And she too was elected in a sort of almost guerrilla pincer move. And actually with her slate had a group of foreign workers who were again working in the service sector of the tourism industry, essentially the nobodies in the views, in fact, of many trade unions as well, who had come on with her. And she ended up getting elected big time and having the first board of a trade union in Icelandic history, the majority of whom were not from Iceland. So, it's not just here, but we have really been behind the curve on that sort of vigorous trade unionism. And it looks like that is actually in there. We're going to find the same with the National Education Union, if I've got that right, which was another union that has arisen during all the hassle with COVID and so on, and has really ousted some of the other unions in England on the education front. They were just waiting to see the scale of the inflation announcement today before putting their own pay offer in, which I'd imagine will be 9%. And if they don't get that, there will be a strike. And they mean it. And actually, you know, Nick Jones, who is a veteran BBC Labour correspondent, was on Scotland Tonight last night. And honestly, Nick is brilliant. He is such a kind of careful and kind of, well, actually, you know, he was that, like, that old fashioned school sort of Labour correspondent that really knew absolutely everyone in the trade union movement and knew his stuff. And he was making much the same point, you know, that the number of well-organized trade unions now is really very high. And he saw lots of parallels with the, you know, summer of discontent, because he sees Mick Lynch not just as a fairly charismatic character, but one who is willing to say, beneath our banner, the rest can shelter.
Yes.
So that's also a quite political move, you know, given that actually Labour didn't undo the anti-trade union laws that were put in by Margaret Thatcher. So he's coming as close up to the line as it's possible to get without going for secondary picketing, which is, you know, you're not allowed to come out in support of other people's trades disputes. So it's all, I mean, basically, it's all very interesting. And I know we could spend a while talking about the ins and outs of kind of the rail cases. I mean, I'm intrigued as well with the language that's used. I mean, now everybody's talking about modernization, because that's the argument being put and the phrase being used by the British government and the employers. But, you know, this rings bells to me, because if you go to the north of Scotland and see reference to the clearance lairds, they're never called that. They're called agricultural improvers. And if you start to look and remember what was happening in the first years of the austerity government, of the Cameron government, it wasn't cuts to benefits. It was reforms.
Yes.
And, you know, as soon as you start to use that language, you've lost half the battle, because it may well be, some of this might be about modernization, but I would love to see Mick Lynch with enough time to have a real square go on some of the examples that are being thrown around, because when he gets a chance, he absolutely tends to nail what sounds like an open and shut case, because no one ever expects the other side to have a very good explanation for the safety that's involved in it. So I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about that when we've got over the results of the by-elections tomorrow.
Yeah. Yes, because Tiverton and Honiton by-election, and it's what's going on there? I mean, the Conservatives are playing very much hardball. I don't know if you saw the leaflet they put out, which was in Liberal Democrat colours, and it's not targeting Liberal Democrat voters. They've given up on them in this blue wall area, trying to appeal to wavering voters who might otherwise vote for UKIP, the Forum for Britain movement, Heritage Party. They're definitely appealing to the right, and they're worried about the split on the right-wing vote, and they've got they're going really hard on this right-wing message, which is being punched on, because behind a lot of this you've got the Emerons Greece, which is Linton Crosby, who's come over from this from Australia, where, by the way, just on a quick reference back, he tried this, it's Labour's rail strikes in the run-up to the Australian general election, in an attempt to, and that's what we've got going on here, an attempt to actually lay the blame for the rail strikes on the Labour Party in Australia. It didn't work there, and it doesn't appear to be working over here. But the Tiverton and Honiton one, the Tories are going very right-wing. They look as if they're going to take a hammering there with people deserting from the Lib Dems, and similarly with the polls up in Warrington. Is it Wakefield? Sorry.
Yeah.
I knew it was a rugby league team.
Yes, it does look in both directions as if... As they have that terrible expression, the you know, the Tories, they've priced this in, that basically the two of them will be lost. So then it's just a question of how easy it is to shrug off yet another reality that, you know, in any normal democracy, losing two by-elections in 1 week to different parties in different parts of the country with different political, you know, sort of backgrounds would seem to be. And it's extraordinary, because Tiverton, I think some of these places, it's terrible to say, but Tiverton and Honiton, they sound like somebody's just made them up. But anyway, it's got a majority of 24,000.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that should be quite a big thing. And yet they will absolutely try to just shrug it off. Although I see that there's already some Tories beginning to kind of, you know, suggest that this could create a tornado that unseats Boris Johnson. But it would have to be a tornado that operates in extremely strange weather, because, you know, he's just got a couple of weeks to go till he can crawl into the summer recess. And, you know, if they haven't managed to strategize to get rid of him yet, it does feel to me like I'm going to lose my bet with you. So we'll see what happens. No, but that's fair enough. I'll pay. I absolutely put the what was it? The fiver? The fiver?
Oh, 50, I thought it was. I mean, but that's.
Yes. So it's all as it, you know, as it was. But I don't, I mean, you know, it does look like it is still just a question of when, you know, Boris goes. It's just that they haven't been able to kind of get themselves reorganized in time for the summer.
Yeah, talking about going, I mean, this is a topic which I've got extreme distaste in coming to, which is the Patrick Grady issue. And my feeling about it is there was a whole lot of talk has been going on with people whom I respect in terms of the coverage of this turning and saying, wasn't appalling that someone actually leaked an audio recording of the SNP parliamentary group meeting, for which Ian Blackford and Amy Callaghan have had to apologise for the comments they made. My perspective is, if you think that the leaking of a meeting, which in my opinion, did not take seriously the case against Patrick Grady and the behaviour he engaged in, if you think the leaking's the problem, you're the problem. Victims are victims, no matter who they are and which political party you happen to support. So that's my take on it. And I find the whole thing extremely distasteful, with some Angus Robertson turning saying, well, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. That's whataboutery of the nth degree. You know, bad behaviour is bad behaviour, no matter who does it. And as we've said in the past before, I'm not prepared to wish for Indy for what I believe to be inexcusable behaviour.
Yep, I would completely agree with that. I mean, this has kind of been sitting bubbling under as a subject for the last couple of weeks. And it doesn't, since we're not in the SNP, that doesn't seem to be, you know, really kind of strictly relevant, because it looked like it was sorting itself out. But that kind of non-apology, really, I mean, it was the fact that Amy Callaghan put out a tweet that did seem like a genuine, I'm really sorry about that, you know, I made a mistake. Then contrasted, too unfortunately, I'm afraid, with Ian Blackford's I'm sorry you feel offended line, which is a classic of people who are not really apologising and just dumping the problem back on you, that you've got your kind of feelings in a bit of a twist. I mean, you know, there's no point going into, I don't know any of the people involved, and we're neither of us are in the SNP. They've clearly got, you know, there's been a couple of, on the other hand, there was somebody, another Patricia Gibson, who I think, who was found found for on appeal when there was another question of harassment facing her. So, you know, there seems to be quite a bit going on. And of course, there's all, you know, these rumours of previous ministers who've still got cases to answer. It's unquestionably the case that, you know, when the going gets tough, all sorts of dirt starts getting flung at people to try to kind of just stop politics being discussed. And so I think probably that was where both of us were a bit, you know, where is this coming from? But as you say, it just doesn't matter. Once you've got a case that there is an accepted transgression has happened and there is someone who is the complainer and the victim, you just cannot end up having a situation where they're being dismissed and dissed essentially by the Westminster group of the SNP. And you would ask, as you just as you say, it's always the case that people who get more parties that get more worried about who leaked something than the contents of the leak are invariably on the completely wrong platform. You would want to ask, why, what is going on within the Westminster SNP group that somebody feels they need to record meetings? You know, I don't know. It's, you know, there's obviously more tension going on there than perhaps just the question of support for the individual and the decision to leak. is a really big step to take for somebody within the SNP, because I'm sure it's very probable that people know who it was. And how you operate in that setting within, you know, being employed mm-hmm. within that group, dear only knows. So it just strikes me there's a lot, you know, there's a lot more behind that. And I don't think that Ian Blackford's statement came anywhere near getting rid of this as an issue and sounding genuinely contrite.
Yeah. Meanwhile, on a happier note, you've got an event on tomorrow night. The Europe for Scotland, the light is still on, and you're speaking at it. And I think there's a Billy Kay film or video being shown as well.
There is, but to be honest, neither of us are the highlights in this.
Right.
And I keep trying to say to these guys, you're the real deal here, because it's the Europe for Scotland network that was set up by people based in England who want to see Scotland get back into the European Union, so should we so choose. And they want the EU to try and sort of make that clear before we get into the innards of another IndyRef, so that the suggestion that Europe is hostile to Scotland is not used against independence as an argument as it was last time. And they have all sorts of different reasons for wanting that, but by gum, they are serious. And the Europe for Scotland network have organised people in all the different countries of the EU, have made contacts, they've made little kind of ambassadors for Scotland out of them, which might sound a wee bit sort of pompous, but mm-hmm. it's basically people who have undertaken that come the day and already, they're willing to start lobbying for Scotland in France, in Germany, in Belgium, in the Netherlands. And when you're in a meeting with these guys speaking, you know, with their own accents of English, you know, coming from their own different political perspectives, it's incredibly moving to hear it. You know, to hear other people who have no, you know, they haven't even got Scottish grannies. You know, there's no reason why they would want to be helping us, except that they see lots of positive reasons for Scotland joining. They're looking at accession very probably fast-tracked from Moldova and Ukraine, and seeing that Scotland in economic terms is, you know, with all due respect to those nations, 100% more compliant already with the regulations for EU membership. And they want to, I suppose they want to say to the Scots, you know, we've, you know, the light is still on and we want you back. So that's what the bulk of the meeting will be. I hope I'm only chairing it to let these folk have their say and let people hear folk from across the continent who have got one focus for tomorrow night, and it is Scotland's future as an independent country, which is it's actually astonishing.
Well, I mean, it's incredibly uplifting, actually, because I wasn't fully aware of the whole circumstances. I mean, you have talked about the Europe for Scotland group before, but it sounds terrific. And what I'll do is I'll put the link up in the general show notes. So if anybody wants to register for it, I presume it's an online event.
It is. And it's being live streamed by the estimable Indie Live. So it's going out to a load of different platforms on StreamYard, which will be, I think, the Nationals carrying it, Indie Live's carrying it. So you'll find it in a whole load of different places. But I just look at any sort of social media. And yes, if Pat puts that in the notes, then it's the Lights Still On event. It's 8 o'clock tomorrow, Thursday. And I mean, I would say just come in and sit down and be bathed in the positivity that other Europeans feel towards our country.
Well, we've kind of come full circle and back to where we started, because I began with the black and white television era, and now we've moved into the digital era. And back to that as well, the reason why we're recording on a Wednesday is, ta-da, because you've been up in the Western Isles, Leslie.
Aye, yes. And just to give everybody, you know, the sort of name checks for doing the business, yes, Lough Aber organised yet again a really good event. They showed the Norway and Iceland films, and, you know, it's funny because I had to really crank my brain up again for it, because, you know, I had all the patter stored there from 2019, and it's 3 years, you know, so you think, oh gosh, am I going to remember it all? But actually, as you watch the films, it's interesting to sort of, you know, see again how people react. So that was a great event, you know, usual great discussions there with Yes Lough Aber. And my goodness, have those guys got the bit between the teeth. They're so, you know, ready to go. They've got very impressive levels of organisation, all the different villages around Fort William. I mean, I was also got a tour around Cool Primary School, which is a fantastic new primary school that has a classroom that's based on taking any kids that are feeling disrupted for whatever reason, and just allowing art and musicians. They've got a musician in residence to help sort of, you know, calm down any kids that might otherwise be deemed disruptive. I was shown round the school by four primary sixes, you know, instead of an actual teacher, mm-hmm. although the head teacher was, you know, lurking in the background. And they were great stuff. I mean, I was asking them what their favourite sort of sports were. And basically it was dodgeball. You know, you have to remember it's primary school. It's mm-hmm. we're not back, you know, we're not in kind of professional sports yet. But we got to the hall and it was interesting that the four of them started just moving around, you know, because you don't know if you remember that, the lovely days when you'd get into the hall, the big hall, your mind would go, all the things you could do in this hall, you know, it's just sort of so appealing. So I was asking them if they actually danced, and they ended up asking me if I danced. And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, we're mm-hmm. going to end up here in a sort of having to dance on the spot thing. So it was a lovely day, actually. And the stunning views you get, you know, you may also, folks, have ploughed up to Fort William, either, you know, to get on the road to the Isles to go further up the road or whatever. But actually just coming back and to Cool, you get look back at Ben Nevis and just the most extraordinary views behind it, you know, which everybody in connected with the event was pretty much walking past, you know, like, I mean, it's the most one of the most striking views in Europe. And people are walking past without giving it a second look, you know, because it's just mm-hmm. they're normal. But anyway, so that was a really good event. And it's impressive, the levels of organization and dedication. And, you know, they're organized like a blooming military machine, these guys, you know, which is tremendously good and to be emulated. And then I went over to the Western Isles and did two wee launch events on the Hebrides book. One was at the Comyn Adrich, which in Ness, which actually I didn't realise, but this was set up by Annie McSween, who I met in Iceland. And she set this up because this is a repository of basically living cultural heritage. All the memories that people have of how things are done, of where people came from, family histories, they're all contained in these buildings, which have now been replicated all the way along the Western Isles. And, you know, could easily be be done firth of the parish. I'm sure here and there are libraries in local areas that are also tremendously painstaking about the local environment. But family is the currency in the Western Isles. Do you know, I can remember once speaking to a tremendous woman, Margaret McKenzie, that I was staying with on the time at Sculpey in Harris. And she said the family was off for a picnic the next day. And I guessed that she would be going to Luskintyre. I mean, after all, it's only the second best beach in the world, you know, and it's on your doorstep. So I said, are you off to Luskintyre then? And she said, no, that is a beach of death for us. And I thought, what? Oh. And what it is there's a cemetery beside Luskintyre and they have to visit the relics.
Oh, right.
And that's how strong the family mm-hmm. connection is. So they go to another beach because it takes too long.
Yeah.
And there's this thing as well. I mean, I was tempted to put a chapter in the book, Who Needs Shops When You've Got Cousins? Because still the West, you know, I thought things would have changed a bit. But seriously, I can remember doing that cycle journey and, you know, salivating over the prospect of getting to a post office actually in Ballallan. After, you know, hours of cycling and imagining what I was going to get from there, whatever, and rolling up, it had closed for half day at 2:30.
God.
At that point, there was nothing else, not even a public toilet. And I can remember actually looking as I was cycling along, just being alert to what might be sitting in the gutter in case somebody had chucked half a Mars bar out of a window or something.
Oh.
And I mean, that's the level of non-provision there is, but there's a reason for it, which is, if anybody is going, as it were, up country, they're on a three-line whip to visit their relatives. You know, oh, for the anonymous coffee that the rest of us can do that sort of, you know, don't have mm-hmm. such a strong family-based culture. Nobody is going to have a random coffee somewhere. So there isn't a sustainable business. And you end up with long, long tracks. I mean, I saw these poor cyclists in the pouring rain, some of them making the awful mistake of cycling north to south into the prevailing wind. Oh, God, did nobody tell you before you started? You know, it's like cycling into a brick wall. But anyway, it was great to meet her. And also Mary Campbell, who was one of the first teachers of in the Glasgow Gaelic school, talking about why there's a Gaelic medium school in Glasgow, which is you learn every subject through the medium of Gaelic, every subject. And there isn't one in the Western Isles.
So that's weird.
It is. And you can have a long conversation about what that's about. It still seems to me that this worry amongst Gaels that actually it's a loser language and it's something to just forget and put behind you, that's still sitting there. And perhaps, you know, the confidence isn't there. All the evidence suggests that kids that are bilingual are just better. You know, it's better for their brains. It makes it easier to learn other languages. It's the norm across Europe. I mean, there's hardly any other country that's monoglot except us. And, you know, Gaelic, if you're going to take a decision of as to what language to do, Gaelic has got, I mean, absolute cast iron guarantee job opportunities associated with it. So it's puzzling why that's still an issue. So, you know, these things are all the stuff that people are talking about. And then I ended up in Bernera, which we spoke about before. This is the island that's been shafted basically by an absentee family that was going to do a buyout, then decided not to, and is now charging people for all sorts of things, going slow, not allowing decrofting to happen, with the result that the shop has closed, the school has closed, the care home has closed. And the profile of the population has changed completely to be much older, which is ironic. It's like a lot of rural areas in microcosm, because as incomers come able to buy up the decrofted houses at more than the locals can afford, they're arriving in places with none of the human infrastructure necessary to support them. So these guys desperately need to be getting on with this. They weren't being helped by the Scottish Government's Community Land Unit. There's now been, as seems, a little bit of energy kicked into the event. And there's been a debate in Parliament about Bernera raised by the local MP, Alistair Allen. But that's not enough either. There's lots of debates, one day debates with, you know, 40 MSPs present if you're lucky. This needs a solution. So these guys are determined to come down to Edinburgh to invite the minister to come and see them, and they're not going to go quietly this time. They need to get backing to get where the rest of their neighbouring communities are, and that is essentially independent. That's what they need. So it was quite a sort of emotional and very jolly kind of event there, and yeah, a long drive home yesterday. So that's that's been me Western Isles, Sally.
Yeah, so it puts my attendance at Newport Primary School's sports day today into the shade, which was very, very exciting and thoroughly enjoyable. It was fantastic to see, and you were just talking about the kids there, the primary six kids. It really was fantastic to see. And talking of which, just give a little preview, folks. If you haven't had enough of the bold Mick, he's on Question Time tomorrow night. So with that delight in store...
Gosh, Wales. I might even watch now.
I'll hold you to that. That and the 5 are going to be due me. We'll see you next week, chums.